The following podcast is offered freely through the Insight Meditation Community of Washington and by Jonathan Faust. To learn more or to make a donation to support this work, please go to www.jonathanfaust.com.
For some reason I could never really explain, I'd always loved the French language, and I'd always had a desire to be able to speak French fluently. So I'd studied French in college and studied some Latin and then had the opportunity to teach in a university in French West Africa. So I grabbed that opportunity and struggling a little bit with the language and so forth. And about a month into my posting, I was still really not that comfortable, a little self-conscious with the language. And I lived in a house right next to the Sûreté Nationale, where people had to check in after crossing the Sahara Desert. So I met lots of really interesting people, and they would come and go. And I had a big house. The only thing I owned of any value were my hiking boots, my size 15 hiking boots, an old typewriter, and my boombox for listening to the radio and music. And so it was easy to have people come and go. And I think what happened was, more and more people got that the house was relatively open, I came back from teaching one day, and my door was wide open, and all my stuff was taken, was stolen. And to my amazement, these two guys showed up at my door a few hours later, two local guys, offering to sell me my stuff back. I was beyond outraged. And I launched into this tirade, just dressing them down, all in French. And I could feel the heat in my body. I could feel this sort of this release, like popping a champagne bottle, you know, just this spewing of vitriol in French. And at one point, I had this thought: you are speaking the best French you've ever spoken in your life. And it was so sudden, I actually laughed out loud. And then I tried to put a cold, hard stare back in my eyes, but the jig was up. The reason why I tell that story is it's, to me, such a classic example of being identified with an emotion and then suddenly recognizing it. And no longer that emotion or that experience no longer having control over you. For me, suddenly became the difference between being angry and being with my anger. And that's a little bit about what I'd like to talk tonight, somewhat of a classical talk, to talk about the fundamentals of the practice that you've been engaged in today, and how to bring this to your practice. And when you play the piano, if you're a piano player, you practice the scales constantly. If you're a baseball player, you practice hitting balls. And when you want to be awake in this life, you practice mindfulness. You practice non-judging awareness. So we're going to talk a little bit about the practice and how the practice is all about now, cultivating this quality, this experience of now. And then to talk a little bit, explore how to be with the moment when it's not about now. There are some classical weather systems that come through. No doubt you may have experienced them at different times, maybe all of them all at once. But to talk about how to recognize these states when they occur and how to bring yourself back to a sense of here and now. There are times when we find ourselves pushing away from our experience. Times when we're grasping. Times when your energy is so low you can barely keep your chin parallel to the floor. Maybe other times where there's so much energy, so much restlessness in the mind that your brain's a little bit like an over-caffeinated rooster. You've had that experience. And then also we'll talk a little bit about some of the classic states that lead to kind of a paralysis, and how to work with those states. Yeah. Eckhart Tolle wrote his book, The Power of Now, which was kind of a sensation, you know. When I've read that book, certainly I was transformed by it, but the way my mind works, I couldn't help but thinking about an alternative to that, which you could call the power of Zen. Maybe you've had that experience when you're sitting and you're thinking, you know, when this meditation is over, Zen, I'm going to be happy. You know, when I get home Monday, Zen, I'm going to be happy. If I could just find the right partner, Zen, I would be happy. That's the way the mind works. One of my teachers always talked about how, you know, we go through different stages in our lives where we think, you know, if I could just find a partner, you know, then I'd be happy. And if we could just have children, I think that then I'd be happy. Then later, if, you know, if we can just get these kids out of the house, you know, then I think I'll be happy. And then if I could just get rid of this partner, then I think I'd be happy. There's this restlessness that's constantly pulling us away from the experience of here and now. The Buddha, after his awakening, realized that everyone is looking for happiness in exactly the wrong way. By pursuing sense pleasures, by avoiding pain, the very practice of doing perpetuates stress and dissatisfaction and suffering. And so the teaching is about coming to the here and now, cultivating mindfulness, or what I like to think of, as I was sharing with the group, the best definition I have for mindfulness is non-judging awareness, the experience of non-judging awareness. So in the practice, we're guided to come back to the senses, to re-inhabit the here and now, to open to the intimacy of what's happening right here in your nervous system. And when you do that, there is a re-arriving. There is a short conversation between the Buddha and a philosopher of his day. And the philosopher said, "I have heard that your teaching is a doctrine of enlightenment. What is your method? What is your practice?" And the Buddha said, "We walk, we eat, we wash ourselves, and we sit." And the philosopher was kind of incredulous and said, well, what's so special about that? You know, everyone walks, everyone sits, everyone washes themselves. And the Buddha said, "Sir, when we walk, we are aware that we are walking. When we eat, we are aware that we are eating. When others walk, eat, wash, or sit down, they are generally not aware of what they are doing." So the moment, the practice is, it's just this, to be aware of your breath. As the Buddha said, when you notice the breath is long, to be aware the breath is long. When the breath is shallow, be aware the breath is shallow. Just this. It's so simple. It's maddeningly simple. Perhaps you've noticed. Has anyone struggled today? And has anyone had any fleeting moments of well-being today, perhaps? Yeah. The breath-based meditation we do, Anapanasati. Now, the word sati means remembering. And so much of the practice is about remembering. Remembering the here and now. Remembering your intention. Remembering why you're practicing. And yet, so often we're pulled away. We either drift away or we're pulled away by these weather systems that come through. A student shared with me not too long ago that she got very interested in meditation and read about it and got real excited about it, so she started shopping. And she got all of her accoutrements, you know, the zafu, the zabaton in matching colors, the timer, the pashmina shawl, you know, that kind of matched everything. And she said she was all set up, got everything right there. And then she thought, she closed her eyes and she thought, well, now what? And that is an important question. Now what? You know, what is it that you're aiming for in your practice? Remembering that can be so helpful. I often teach in large organizations, and for a number of years I taught at the World Bank, and when I would do an introductory lecture on meditation, I would invite people to close their eyes and just call out a word that they associate with the word meditation, you know, or phrase. And people would call out bliss, peace, no thoughts. And then one day there was someone in the back of the room with a smirk on their face, and they said, pain, humiliation, and obsessive thinking. And I said, oh, you meditate. It's very natural to go to a default, to think that meditation is about achieving some particular state. And there are different traditions, different techniques that can help you to achieve different states. You know, breathe in this pattern, do these postures. There is a balance of doing in our practice. There is a balance of willful effort. And there's also a quality of receiving, a quality of just taking in the moment just as it is without trying to change or manipulate it at all. In many ways, once you get seated, the practice begins. What is happening right now? Can I be with this? Father Thomas Keating talked of meditation as a practice of consent, a practice of agreeing with what is here, of saying yes to what is here. And as we go into this, as we go through this talk, we'll have just a few very short little meditations, and perhaps we can close our eyes just for a short little reflection. You might just, in your own way, connect with your breath. Just notice where you feel it the most predominant. And feel the aliveness, the vibration of sounds just as they are. And you might explore, what is it like inside to say yes to this moment? To consent to precisely what is happening right now, and now, and now. And if you like, you can deepen the breath and let your eyes open, or if you prefer, you can remain with your eyes closed. So the question becomes, what is it that we are saying yes to? And different traditions describe it in different ways. Some call it the flow of things, or the stream. And one tradition speaks of this as standing under a waterfall. There's this cascade of phenomena that are passing through every moment, a stream of sensations constantly changing, the sounds, the air temperature, the felt sense of the body. There's the stream of the narrative, the commentary in the mind. There's the stream of emotion, this blend of both sensation and thought, of different moods and emotions that are all part of this stream and this flow. Even different states of consciousness can change and take form as part of this flow or this stream. So when you say yes, a as Rumi says, it's like running a boarding house. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them all at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Is that possible in your practice, to consent to your experience in such a way that everything and anything that's passing through is as if it has been sent as a guide from beyond? Sometimes you can be that welcoming presence. It's effortless just to be present to the flow. Sometimes it's not so easy. We get caught, we get stuck. We have different ways of reacting to our life experience. I'd like to talk a little bit about that, those reactive patterns. Because the more facile that you can become in recognizing the patterns when they arise, that little bit of wisdom can make a big difference in your practice. One of the fundamental acronyms that we use in this practice that many of us are familiar with is the acronym of RAIN, this practice of recognizing or realizing what's arising. And this alone is a very powerful practice. As they say in the shamanic traditions, if you can name a fear, you take its power away, or you begin to take its power away. Sometimes just naming grief or sadness or fantasy can sever your identification with it. It becomes less sticky and allows you to let it flow through. Sometimes it's a little stickier than that. Recognizing or realizing what is here, we can then ask, can I allow this? Can I consent to this? And it's really important to notice here that sometimes the answer is no. When it feels like it's too much, if you are unearthing a memory that has some quality of fear and helplessness that feels traumatic to you, it is entirely skillful to let it know that you see it. Another time when the conditions are different. Perhaps you can be with it then, but if it does not feel safe, it's very skillful to turn your attention elsewhere. Change your focus, change your attention. Go for a walk, have a cup of tea, shift your energy in some way. If you can recognize and allow, make room, consent to your experience, you can then lean in a little closer and explore the I of this acronym, to be intimate with it, to investigate with a quality of curiosity and kindness. It's one of the beautiful distinctions of Vipassana meditation, where you can turn your attention from your anchor to whatever may be arising that is calling for deeper investigation. The end part of this equation speaks to a sense of non-identification. And just as I went through that wave of anger, I was ultra-identified. I was the anger. Something woke up. I recognized it. And once I made that shift to be able to observe the anger, I was no longer identified with it. It was like a weather pattern moving through. The classic story, which probably many of us have heard, but I keep coming back to it for myself, is the story of a yogi meditating in her cave, visited by three demons, whirling around the cave, doing their best to disturb her. She builds a little fire, very calmly, non-reactive. Demons get a little annoyed, so they crank it up a little bit. Images, sounds, horrible stuff. And again, with equanimity, she puts a little tea kettle on over the fire. And this enrages the demons. They throw everything they've got at her. And very quietly, she's putting out some teacups. And finally, the storm stops, the demons stop, they say, what's going on? Were your three deepest wounds, your three worst nightmares. And here you are building a fire, putting on this tea kettle, putting out these teacups. And she says, you've been here before. You'll be here again. So in the meantime, what kind of tea would you like? To me, that's the practice. When you are visited by your demons, and we can think of demons as energy, as weather systems, is it possible to have tea? So one of these mind states has to do with pushing away. It has to do with aversion. Something unpleasant arises, your automatic instinct is to move into aversion. Some flavor of aversion may be anger, judgment, blame, ill will, hatred. And it doesn't matter what it is, something unpleasant, the smell of shampoo in the air, the leaf blower outside. Just to take a little poll, has anyone experienced any aversion today? Of course, this is what the mind does. It's too cold, it's too hot, there's too much instruction, there's not enough instruction. I had too much caffeine, I didn't have enough caffeine. The mind naturally goes into this sort of complaining mode. Story of a man goes to a five-year retreat and he's told he can come, but he can only speak two words a year for his interview. Year one, he has his interview with the teacher. He says, bed hard. The instructor said, well, we're not here to please the senses about, you know, transcending the body, and send him on his way. Second year goes by. He comes back. His interview, he sits. He looks at the master and says, food sucks. Again, the teacher gives a little teaching. He goes off. Third year, he comes back, sits with his master, looks at him and says, I quit. And the master says, this does not surprise me. All you've done is complain ever since you got here. So aversion is this pushing away. It's the judging mind, the comparing mind. And it can be associated to something in the moment, or perhaps you've noticed some memories arise today, anticipating something in the future and noticing the mind going into this whole constellation of aversion. Now, the opposite energy, the opposite force that pulls you away from the moment is wanting. And this is all the different flavors of craving, of planning, of fantasy, of sense desire. It just naturally pulls you away from this still, non-judging, non-conceptual moment. Suddenly you're locked into some form of craving or wanting. Can anyone relate to this state? Ah, yes. There are many, many different flavors of craving and wanting. The mind going into fantasies of how great it's going to be when this retreat is over, and what you might do on Monday. There's someone I know well who has confessed that many of her retreats have been dedicated to remodeling her house. This is often what the mind does when it's not content in the moment. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about how to work with these states, but I'd like to kind of like work through some of the other states that we tend to go through. But to notice how aversion and craving have to do with comparing, not liking something, wanting to move it away, wanting something that isn't here, and moving toward. The third Zen patriarch famously said, To set up what you like against what you don't like is a disease of the mind. And we get to really see this natural function of the mind, moving toward, moving against. The next two weather systems, the next two energies that pull us away, are different energies that, again, take us out of a sense of balance. We have kind of pushing and pulling, and this has to do with energy. I was once leading a retreat with another teacher. This was the 6 o'clock meditation in the morning. And the other teacher was sitting to my right, and she had a boom mic, you know, with a kind of the microphone was right here. And I noticed that she kind of introduced the meditation. I'd look over from time to time, and I noticed her kind of, you know, just nodding off a little bit. I was a little concerned, but then I did my own practice. I kind of forgot about her. And then suddenly there was this boom sound. And I looked over, and her forehead had smashed into the microphone. She tried to make it look like a spiritual experience, but it was pretty clear what had occurred. Sloth and torpor is a quality of hazy, foggy, groggy, sleepy, dense state. How many of us have experienced moments of this? Yeah. On the other hand, where we have sort of not enough energy, sometimes the mind can get very activated, where it feels like there's too much mental energy. I was interviewing someone who said that after his meditation, he found he could really relate to the hamster in his daughter's bedroom, because he had spent all day on a hamster wheel trying to figure out this business problem that he had to solve. He said, "I realized I've been running as fast as I can, getting absolutely nowhere." So the restlessness oftentimes is related to worry and to anxiety, the inability to settle in one place. Perhaps you can relate to that as well, restlessness. So sleepiness is an interesting thing to explore. Oftentimes on retreat, I find, particularly in the first day or two, is quite biological. We are a depleted, overstimulated culture. So when you come and you sit and you close the eyes and your primary attention is opening to the senses, the body's going to let you know what it needs. And so that's where you'll find yourself doing the whiplash meditation. You haven't done that before. Once on retreat, I went to brush something off my shoulder and I found out it was the floor. That was a sign of being a little over the edge. Now, what's interesting as we explore our relationship to these states, sleepiness and grogginess, density, can also have an emotional quality to it as well. It can be a way that we disengage when something unpleasant comes up. It's kind of a form of numbing ourselves. So that can be an element as well. But I also like to point out that quite often in meditation, when you feel that sense of sleepiness, you're really experiencing a brainwave shift. And the brainwaves you're experiencing are the brainwaves of sleep. They're the theta-level brainwaves. And yet there's a quality of wakefulness there. So oftentimes the instruction, as Tara had mentioned, to turn your attention to sounds. Because just a little more stimulation can allow you to actually perhaps stabilize your attention in a very, very interesting state of consciousness where spatial and temporal awareness feel different inside. Opening your eyes, you can bring in a little bit more stimulation and stabilize your attention there perhaps. Or again, as Tara said, to stand and let that sleepy wave pass through. On the other hand, the quality of restlessness, the quality of sort of the jumpy mind, can be a very powerful thing to investigate as well. There is sort of the state itself, the mind jumping from one thing to the next. What I've often found for myself, that that's many ways it's tied into a quality of worry, some quality of anxiety. And that's often tied into sort of an emotional experience that becomes very ripe for investigation, which we'll explore in a few minutes. One of the most important things to remember whenever you experience any one of these states is that they are not permanent. When you find yourself caught in strong aversion, in playing out a story of anger or judgment or blame, or when you wake up from a long riff of fantasy or planning, or when you find yourself caught in sleepiness or restlessness, they can feel permanent. But there are four magic words to remember. These are the four words that can make a happy person sad and a sad person happy. This too shall pass. So it's very helpful to remember when you're in periods of struggle that this will pass. And equally, if you're experiencing a sense of equanimity, a sense of balance, a sense of arrival, this too will pass. So there's another quality, another weather system that can oftentimes lead to a kind of paralysis. And these have to do with the mind state of doubt and kind of the ruthless critic. One time on retreat, there was someone who kind of stopped coming to sessions. And got to explore that with the person. And there was, she reported a sense of feeling so unworthy because she was struggling so hard in her practice. And we got to explore that whole quality of doubt and self-criticism. Have you had the thought today, I'm not doing this correctly? I'm the only one in here who's not doing this right. Everyone else is doing it right. The root of doubt can be directed internally toward yourself, but doubt can also be externally, doubting the choices in your life, doubting the teachers, doubting the fact that you're here, and other alternatives that you might have. And doubt becomes a very interesting object for investigation. Because doubt is neither good nor bad. In fact, doubt can be embraced in this practice. Doubt is really tied into critical thinking. It's about discerning what's real and what's not real in your life. When you ask yourself, what is this experience right now? As you examine what's arising, using doubt or critical thinking can be very helpful. Is this anger that I'm feeling inside? Or is this perhaps disappointment? That kind of wise discerning can be very, very helpful. When we are caught in doubt, as I mentioned, there can be a quality of paralysis that occurs. The third Zen patriarch talked about the antidotes to doubt. One of them being having a strong intellectual understanding. And I have found that very helpful, particularly when I am on retreat, and to really embrace the fact that you're doing something quite extraordinary here. In the midst of a busy, active life filled with commitments and responsibilities, you are pausing. You are deeply pausing. And in that pause, so much can arise. I was sharing in group earlier today that for many years I would supervise fasting retreats where We would refrain from eating our regular food and either have juice or a mono diet and pay attention to what happens. And people would go through amazing detox experiences as the body would get rested and get stronger, just sort of throwing off what was no longer needed. And in that same way, I think of a meditation retreat as a detox retreat as well. You are refraining from habitual activity. You are doing nothing but good things. You are steeping yourself in nature. You're around like-minded people. The threat of the world is at bay. And quite naturally, what is no longer needed will arise to the surface. Whatever is undigested in your life, whatever is between you and feeling free, feeling happy, will in its own organic way find its way into your awareness to be seen, to be recognized, to be named, to be open to be investigated, ultimately to be met with empathy and compassion. Remembering the extraordinary practice that you're engaged into can be very, very helpful when you hit the hard stuff. The other antidote to doubt, the third Zen patriarch described it as cultivating the faith mind. And I like that word because it means that each of us has to define for ourselves what that means. What is it that you release something into? What does faith mean to you? Whether that be nature or awareness or a path or a teaching. Something larger than you into which you can release your stress, your suffering. And for me, in many ways, this quality of the faith mind is simply this realm of empathy, kindness, and compassion. When I can meet my struggles with a sense of kindness, something can begin to shift inside. So I thought we might do a little exploration. One of the great benefits of the practice, I find, and recognizing these five states, these five mental states, aversion, anger, judgment, blame, craving, planting, fantasy, wanting, sense pleasure, sloth and torpor, the heaviness, density, sleepiness, that cycling down into a depressive state, restlessness, all the subcategories of worry and anxiety, and this whole category of doubt and self-criticism. As I like to say, the good news is there are only five. And the bad news is they're very, very pervasive. But as you begin to pause and slow down and relax, inevitably, you will more and more quickly be able to recognize and name the hindrance that's interfering. Because these hindrances have in common one particular thing, and that is when they are present, it is impossible to be present. They obscure any sense of equanimity, any sense of open-heartedness. So when you're aware of something that's between you and feeling free, it can be quite helpful to name that hindrance. Just recognizing can be quite powerful. So I thought we might do a little guided meditation exploring these stages of rain, and you can choose your hindrance. If there's one that's been particularly persistent today, you might recall that experience, and we'll do a little guided reflection. I'll be inviting you to reflect into it, and I'll be offering a few questions and some space for you to do your own investigation. So you might bring into mind a time today where you found yourself struggling, perhaps where things weren't going your way. And again, this might be a moment of finding yourself caught in some form of aversion or craving, wanting mind, perhaps sloth and torpor, worry, restlessness, or doubt. You might take a few moments just to bring your attention to the breath. And in your own way, just sense that experience. Just naming it. And you might inquire if you can allow or accept this. Can you make room for this quality of mind? And if so, you might explore in your own way what it's like to have tea with this demon, this energy. The primary inquiry might be to explore what it feels like on the inside. What is the felt sense experience of this mind state? And you might explore, rather than trying to fix it or nuke it or make it go away, if you were to simply be with it, to be curious, if you were to hold this in some quality of loving presence, some quality of kindness or empathy or compassion, you might notice if it might move or shift or change in any way. Is there a sense of how this mind state, how this energy would like you to be with it right now? A sense of what it might need? Notice how it may have shifted in just these few minutes. You might sense if there's any quality or flavor of the in aspect of rain, a sense of non-identification, a sense of non-grasping, just feeling it as a weather system moving through. If you like, you can deepen the breath and let this experience fall away. If you like, you can open your eyes or remain with them closed. What I find in my experience is I have moments of equanimity or ease, and then there'll be some disturbance in the force. Something arises that pulls me away from now-ness. And I begin to feel it as a tightening inside. And the Tibetans refer to it as shempa, sort of the inner clench. When that clench begins to tighten and harden, there's some form of resistance. I'm resisting something. And as I resist, the intensity of that sensation begins to build. It builds like a wave. As the discomfort gets stronger and stronger, our tendency naturally is to jump off that wave. And the way we jump off the wave is either we'll blow it off through anger or judgment or blame, or we'll disassociate by going into planning or fantasy, or we'll just pull the plug, lose energy, go into sloth and torpor. Or we'll get hyper worried and anxious and sort of spin out around it. Or we'll get paralyzed in doubt. I can't do this. I can't be with this. This is too much. If it's possible to stay on the wave, to stay with that rising resistance, and by staying with it, to recognize it, to ask, can I be with this right now? Can I stay with this? What I find is on the other side of that wave, there's usually a crest. On the other side of the wave will be some experience that will have a range to it for me. Sometimes it's just a range like something just passed through. I have no idea what it was. Sort of like an energetic wave went through and I feel a little more clear, a little more relaxed on the other side of the wave. Sometimes there'll be a cognitive insight. I'll have some cognitive recognition of what I was holding on that I just let go of. But quite often, it's just a sense of some weather system came through, I stayed with it, and it moved on. Part of the art of practice is noticing when the resistance arises. I've noticed for myself that the intensity of the resistance, if I can stay with it, on the other side of that, the release is usually as great, if not greater, than the resistance itself. So this becomes a real opportunity to practice. There is a men's group that meets in D.C. It's called M3, Men Meeting for Meditation. And when they do their sharing, they talk about their AFGO. And the acronym for AFGO, I'll change one word slightly, is another freaking growth opportunity. In this practice, we have AFGO after AFGO. We arrive, we bring ourselves present. We consent to our experience. And in its own amazing, organic, intelligent process, something will arise. And you'll notice some degree of resistance, some form of pushing away, some form of holding on, low energy, high energy, doubt. If it's possible, the opportunity becomes to recognize it, give it a name, sense if you can open, allow. And then, if the conditions are right, allow yourself to be intimate with this. Can you imagine as something sent as a guide from beyond, a teacher coming to you? That's the possibility. And equally, when it's not possible to stay on that wave, when you're caught in aversion, when you're caught in craving and you can't be with it, the practice is non-judging awareness. Can you be with that? Can you bring kindness to that? When we engage into this practice, we are studying reality. We are striving to really understand what is true. There is an analogy that sometimes can be very helpful, and we'll close with this in our final meditation. When we begin to recognize everything that changes, and everything born out of causes and conditions is subject to change, we begin to see just how pervasive this flow, this stream is, the constant cascade of sensations, thoughts, and this living mechanism, this living body, the narrative that doesn't stop, the constant reaction to what's happening in the moment, leaning toward, pushing away, it's all happening in a sense of flow. And yet, there is awareness. There is the light of awareness. The analogy that some find helpful is to imagine who you are as the mountain and to sense these weather systems as the clouds passing through. It's helpful to recognize and to remember that when aversion is present, awareness is not aversive. Awareness is not craving. Awareness is not sleepy. Awareness is not restless. Awareness is not doubting. And who you are is the awareness. So let's close with a little meditation. As you feel the breath, you might feel your connection to the earth, the points of contact between your chair or the cushion or bench. And feel the outline of your body. You might imagine yourself as the mountain, as a vast mountain. And sense as this mountain, everything that is changing. Feel the aliveness of sound. This movement of the breath on the inside. Perception of pulse, of tingling, vibration of subtle energy, both inside and around your body. This stream of phenomena coming through the sense doors. The stream of mental formations. This amorphous play of mood or emotion. And sense your capacity to recognize what is here. Your capacity to allow or consent to what is here. Your capacity to open into intimacy, into a deep investigation. Into the phenomena that are here right now. Your capacity to let it be. As a piano player practices scales, as a baseball player practices hitting balls, we practice non-judging awareness, resting intimately in the here and now. And when you are inevitably pulled away from the now, you might reflect on these words in this poem. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still. And just like that, something in me settles, softens, and makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life is not a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe and be and walk slowly into the mystery. And gently deepening the breath. Namaste. Thank you for your kind attention. It's a deep honor to share this practice with you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.